Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandergrift.
It's Tuesday, January 7th from HBR2. It's The Conversation. First up, the legality of blocking off Laniakea Support Park. We'll talk with one of the plaintiffs in the suit brought this month against the state's Department of Transportation.
And then we'll have a visit with Nene Goose before we head up to the Kilauea Observatory. And we'll also see what's brewing in your brains when we drop into a neighborhood coffee spot.
So stay here. The conversation starts right after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Today we're going to talk a lot about access to information and just general access.
On the North Shore, access is a word you'll hear quite a bit of.
And we expect that we're going to hear more of that in our first conversation. Now, if you live on the North Shore, if you visit there, you may have had a few near misses with people darting across Kamehameha Highway. Or maybe you've cursed in frustration as yet another car trying to park slowed the flow of traffic. Both reasons led the State Department of Transportation to put up barricades to block off the beach. But some area residents and a community group say those barricades are illegal, and they're suing to make the point and to get those barriers removed. Bill Martin is one of the plaintiffs, and he joins us by phone now. Good morning.
Good morning.
This is a very tough situation for your community because it's dividing people from what they feel they should be able to get from their area. How do you reconcile some of what's happening and has happened since you were party to this suit that was just announced last week?
Well, it is a tough issue, and for myself, I live on the Kahuku side of Laniakea, so I drive through there at least twice a day. And we've been experiencing this backup for the traffic for years now. And so it is tough, and it's kind of hard for me to actually step up and take a stance on this because, people, we are desperate out here for a solution to the traffic problem. But the barriers and the DOT's response to this is just not acceptable.
If that's not acceptable, and as you say, this is a very tough thing for you to do, and also, as you mentioned, this has been an ongoing conversation for so many years, what are you talking about with some of your friends and neighbors out there that might be a more equitable situation?
Well, There's a gentleman out here. His name is Bill Quinlan, and he doesn't like much publicity or credit for anything. But he came up with a real simple little bypass that utilizes the existing bridge, and it just basically goes around the shore area, and inside of that loop would be like a nice little parking and. Basically utilizing the city park, which is already there. And that would be one real simple solution. And also the DOT has indicated, plans to do a bigger bypass. But there's problems with that. But I think in the short term, if we... I would hope that maybe the governor would declare a state of emergency on this so we could fast track just a simple little bypass.
You say simple little bypass, but as we know living here, not a lot of things really are simple. Do you have a cost attached to that?
Oh, I have no idea, and especially when it comes to government spending, it would be nuts. But, you know, the North Shore is a treasure out here, and we are very underappreciated. About half of the tourists that come to Oahu come to the North Shore, and our infrastructure here is terribly lacking. You know, there's no toilets for visitors. The roads are a mess. I think it would be a worthy investment, no matter the cost.
Well, still, there's the issue of how much money is available to do all the great many things that we have to do, and the fact that you all who live there have to traffic the area on a daily basis, or in your case, trying to use the park. Do you have any other ways of being able to access the park if you can't get through it where you usually come through it, Laniakea?
No. Basically, I'm in a wheelchair, and I use a modified powered electric chair with kind of big sand tires, and there's really three beaches that I can access along this strip. There's Sunset Beach, Waimea Bay, and Laniakea, and all of those have issues, but Laniakea is the shortest and the easiest access that I can get to the ocean to go swim or surf, mainly surfing.
Shortest and easiest, but that sounds like if you had to, you could find some other way of doing it.
If I have to, yeah, I have the other two choices, but they're quite difficult. Electric wheelchair is not a ATV, and if you've been to Waimea Bay, you know how big and long and steep that beach is. So I've never even tried there. And Sunset Beach also has a lot of challenges. But basically, that's where I can get to the beach. That's it.
So, Mr. Martin, what do you say when you talk to other people and they say, "Well, you have very specialized needs, and we're trying to weigh those needs against the entire community that feels a sense of consternation, or those in the community who feel a sense of consternation at the cars that stop and the people that dart across the highway." How do you create some sense of balance with those two sets of needs?
Well, to be honest, I didn't join this move or whatever, this lawsuit, because of my disability. To be honest, it's to do with the barriers and the fact that the DOT has said that it's a experimental or trial, but there's no time at all given. There appears to be no traffic studies to see whether it's working or not, which is not. It's actually way more dangerous. You know, just drive by there, and then people come out and look, and they go, "Oh, it's fine." But the traffic problem is only at peak hours and during the weekends, or especially some holidays. Not only that time, but that is when it's really bad, and so. That whole this is like a traditional surf spot for the whole island, for the world really. This is the first beach that you come to.
Right, but you're talking issues of access, and you're talking issues of legality in the lawsuit that seem to be not quite at odds with each other, but at least looking at this from two different ways, of one wanting to be able to have access to something that's in your neighborhood, but also looking at the legalities of how the DOT put up the barriers, even though it may just be for short term, whatever short term may be.
Yes, exactly. And then, you know, I'm not an expert on the legalities of it, but just in as a common sense kind of approach, It's just not the right thing to do. And
all right, well, we're going to leave it right there for the moment because it's such a new thing. We'll be watching it, as I know all of you will be too. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You.
Bill Martin is a business owner, longtime Sunset Beach resident, and a wheelchair confined surfer who uses Laniakea Support Park. He's also a board member of the North Shore Chamber of Commerce and part of the State Department of Transportation's Kamehameha Highway Realignment Task Force. That task force voted against the barricades, and now Mr. Martin is one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit to get those barriers removed.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14. Coming up, a little coffee talk for a Tuesday morning and the lessons of a Nene Goose. But first, your backyard quiz.
Ulana, o mau, o kaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
The Lava Flow Hazard Zone System is used to designate the severity of danger posed by volcanic lava in certain areas of Hawaii, and today it's the subject of our quiz. The system was originated by the United States Geological Survey and highly useful, especially on Hawaii Island, due to its near-constant volcanic activity. Now, the system classifies hazard zones on a scale of 1 to 9, and for today's backyard quiz, we're hoping that one of you will tell us the names of the two geologists who first implemented the system in 1974. You can post it to Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or just wait for the answer a little later in the show. And while you're out still thinking, we are going to start a little bit of a new tradition. A new year is always a good time to start such things, and that's why we'll be checking in on the issues taking up mental real estate with some of the folks at Morning Spots somewhere on Oahu starting Tuesday. So we're going to find out today where Bill Sage is hanging out, and it happens to be at the Kimbo Bean at the Discovery Bay Center. Hey, Bill, what's brewing?
Good morning. Good morning, Beth. And actually, Kimo Bean and Discovery
I'm
Bean.
I'm sorry.
Discovery Bean Center. Yeah, well, I'm discovering I have a bean, and right now it's caffeinated. But we have two very articulate people here this morning. We have MC, and she's from Georgia originally, and we have Philip, who is from Hawaii locally. They're both, surprise, surprise, 22, and I thought, what a perfect thing. Genuine millennials who are here to find out what's on their mind. So, MC, we're going to lead off with you. You came here from Atlanta sort of on a whim, and you're a nursing student. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct.
So what happened? What got you to Hawaii in the first place?
It was a really spontaneous move. I just met a friend, and he said he'd always wanted to move to Hawaii, and I was kind of sick of living in Atlanta, and I figured if I'm going to be a broke student, why not do it in paradise?
So your eventual plan is to perhaps establish residency and move here permanently?
Yes, that is the short-term plan.
So in the meantime, you came out here pretty much, what, about 3 months ago?
That's right.
You found yourself looking for a place that was expensive in Waikiki, so you moved to a nice little local place called Waianae.
Yes, we all moved to Waianae, which was quite an experience.
And you found out the people there, some people, oh, Waianae is a crazy area, and yet you found there was a lot of aloha spirit.
Yeah, it was actually really great out in Waianae. A lot of people warned us about the locals, I would say. They, you know, just said be careful. But all the locals were really nice and very helpful with the bus and helping us get around, being new to the island and stuff. So that was cool.
So essentially, the aloha spirit is where you find. There could be aloha spirit, maybe called the haiyao spirit at Atlanta, where you're from.
Yeah.
But here, so you're working local. You're working locally as a waitress right now, is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
And eventually it's going to become the medical healing arts profession.
Exactly.
But you seem to have the inspiration of the Aloha Spirit, so you're here. It is a beautiful place, and I think your hometown is about 4 degrees right now.
So. Yeah, it is really cold.
Well, that's why we keep Chemo Bean at a comfortable 65 degrees, so you can remind yourself of what you're getting away from. Well, thank you very much for talking with us, MZ. We hope you have all success in this life and business. And right now we're talking with Phil, who is same age, and Phil happens to be somebody who grew up here. And Phil, you actually graduated 5 years ago.
Yeah, I graduated 5 years ago from Punahou.
All right.
Yeah.
And a math major.
Yep, I just actually graduated December 2012. Yeah, math at Creighton University.
So Creighton University, you became a math major, and now you are working in a coffee shop.
Yeah, I do this, plus I also teach math at Nanakuli High School.
Okay, so you got a combination from Waianae to Nanakuli. The connections are absolutely wonderful. Do you find that being from here helps to local kids? Sometimes they say, well, if they can't really speak well, they can't be that smart, but you found that's not true necessarily.
Yeah, that's not necessarily true. I know some kids, they're really smart, and, you know, sometimes maybe they don't speak as well, I guess.
But even so, the fact that you're a math teacher who's born and raised here, you can inspire them to do their best.
Yeah, I'd like to think so.
So you bring them coffee in the morning?
I don't know about that, but I do bring them, well, my knowledge, and hopefully I can pass it on to them.
That's a good thing. So the kids really like what you're doing.
I'd like to hope so, at least.
As we say to math majors around town, go figure, and they will keep figuring. I'd like to thank you very much, Phil, and thank you, MC, for being with us. Next week, we'll be out in Wahiawa at Surfers Coffee Bar. In the meantime, keep drinking coffee and running those green lights. Back to you guys in the studio, and aloha.
Now from social people to an old and cranky character who tells herself she just doesn't need anybody. And a character she is, literally. Auntie Martha is an ornery loner who lives alone by the beach. She doesn't need company, or so she thinks, until a Nene Goose comes into her life. The new Honolulu Theater for Youth production is an adaptation of a play that director Annie Wood Cusick wrote in her native Scotland and adapted for a Hawaii setting. She's with us this morning. Good morning, Annie.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
Pleasure.
How tricky was it to adapt your story to Hawaii?
You know, I thought it would be, but it wasn't at all tricky because Martha was originally set on the Scottish island of Islay, where I grew up. Mm-hmm. It was a very small island with a population of 3,500. I always think it's the size of Punahou School. So everybody knows everybody, and everybody knows everybody's business as well. But when we came to do it here, I thought, oh yeah, you know, she should be Hawaiian, and we'll have this Hawaiian hat, and we do. We have all that, and it looks different. But the story is the same. You know, we have a Nene Goose instead of a white goose, and it was hardly any difference, because growing up on island, although it's vastly smaller than Hawaii, it's the same kind of experience, I think, living on an island. It's the same community spirit. There's the same beauty that you see every day. And, mm-hmm. you know, and she lives on a beach. So it was, you know, apart from the weather.
Your dad was a postmaster growing up, which sort of made him a connector to everyone on your island. Yeah?
That's right. It was a really important job. You know, he started off as a young man, as a postie, a mailman, they call them here.
Uh-huh.
We did have to change that. We had to change the language because, you know.
The term postie
I was like,
here.
Do they not say postie here? No, mail carrier.
I love that
call
term,
mailman.
Though.
The postie.
The postie, it's
yeah.
great. Yeah,
yeah. I was,
it's like cabbie or something.
Yeah, he's a postie. So he was a postie then. He was a postmaster on the island, and for sure. So if, you know, we were like 2 hours on a ferry from the mainland Scotland. So if there was a storm, which there was often, and the boat didn't come in and the plane didn't come in, then the mail didn't come in. So people would literally come up to our house saying, where's my mail? He's like, I can't control the weather, you know?
Yeah.
So, Yeah, so I like to have posties in my plays, and I've had a few of them because I think they deliver something surprising. Or you always go, oh, what's arrived today? I hope
true,
it's not a bill.
They're a deus ex machina, right? They can bring anything and change the plot any
absolutely,
way you want.
Absolutely. They can change the day and make you feel great or not. Anyway, so there is a postie in Martha as well, who is the only connection she has with the outside world, because he has to go to her beach and he has to endure her snappiness and her grouchiness, you know, on a daily basis. However, that changes because of the arrival of the Nene Goose in her life. And, you know, he totally warms her heart. And so when the postie comes back at the end, he experiences a different Martha. In fact, this is one little detail we have added. He experiences a Martha who is now wearing a flower in her hair.
Uh-huh.
And that's very different from the Martha that he met in the very beginning.
What a perfect little visual signal of the transformation in your character.
Yeah, and that was something, obviously we don't have that in Scotland because we don't, I mean, you don't get flowers in the winter. So you can't
put
flowers in.
But you know, what I was thinking when you talked about where you grew up, Annie, is that's the kind of place where you make your own fun, right?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, you make your own fun. But also, I do remember as a teenager, it was very, very boring. There really wasn't anything to do. We didn't have a swimming pool. We didn't have a movie theater.
Yeah.
There was like three shops.
You sort of had to write plays or something, didn't you?
I was actually in the amateur dramatic club. Of course. Of course I did that. And we spent a lot of time wandering around the beaches and just hanging out. Friends became really important, and radio became really important. Mm-hmm. And because we were so remote, we only got a good signal until 10:30 at night. And as a teenager, of course, you want to listen to music all night long.
Sure.
So we'd have to get this crackling. We used to get like European stations. It was like this different language. You didn't know what it was, but there was music.
Yeah.
So you'd get this really medium wave, really awful reception till midnight. And then really it was time for bed after that. But yeah, it was a very, you know, it was all about friendship and all about community and, you know, creating events together.
And the life of the imagination, I would think.
Yes. A lot of wistful thinking. In fact, as a child, I used to run up the hill with my pal, and because we were so far west, the airplanes would fly over, come into America, and we used to like stick our thumbs up and go, give us a ride to America, give us a ride. And we'd just only dream of like going that way, you know, heading over that way instead of heading to the mainland.
That's a great little scene for a future play of yours.
That's
a nice little moment. It really is.
It's a moment that I really remember. Actually, I have a picture of us on that hill, and that's not far from where I actually always imagined Martha's house being, just by that beach, because there was always a few reclusive people on Isla, you know.
Sure.
Actually, we used to call him the Boatdach, which is a Gaelic name for old man. And we said, he lives down by the caves and you don't talk to him. And he was just this really old man. He was probably a wonderful artist or something, you know.
Yeah.
Misunderstood. He wore a kilt, had a big walking stick, and he would walk. He definitely lived out by the beach, but I don't know where. But, you know, as a child, you just make up all sorts of, like, the Boatdach, and he lives all these things about him. So
what a great
there's
term.
Always these, you know, reclusive characters that we're intrigued about and how they exist. You know, I mean, here in Hawaii as well, there's Mango Man and Kailua. You know, it's like who stands there, and people don't really. He doesn't converse with anyone.
A lot of times, the people who push people away really yearn for human companionship, and that's kind of anti-Martha, yeah?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, she's very much in the beginning, I don't need anybody. No, I'm not going to watch the regatta. I'm fine on my own. I can do that. Fine, thanks. Now just go away. She's like that with the postie, and then when the goose comes, the difference with him is that he just persists. He just keeps coming back, and she, you know, keeps yelling at him, keeps telling him to go, and eventually she leaves him outside in the thunderstorm, you know. Poor wee goose. He's so soaking wet.
Poor goose, yeah.
I know. And then the next morning, he's really sick. So there's a change there. Yeah. So then she feels a bit guilty and, like, responsible. And despite everything else, she opens up her house and opens up her heart.
Some humanity emerges.
Yeah. And he goes in, and she nurses him back to health. And then the fun really starts, and they just connect, and it's beautiful. It's beautiful, and it's great fun to watch. It's very funny.
It's a lovely story,
funny.
Annie. It really, and you tell it. Just hearing you tell it, it really is compelling.
Yeah, I enjoy it. I mean, there's not many. Often, as a director and writer, you watch your own stuff. You go, "Oh, I want to make that different. Oh, I still don't like that." But when we started doing this with H2Y, I thought, oh, great, here's a show I know works. I mean, it's traveled all over the world since 1999 is when I first wrote it. I had no idea back then that it would have such a big life. You know, we basically, me and my two friends got together. We said, let's do a show, because we wanted to do a show together. And we'd worked together before, and we thought, let's do it, and we'll do it for schools. We'll tour two schools a day. And it took on this huge life of its own and became this big international success. And I think because it is so heartwarming, and people really like to have hope, you know?
That
hope.
They do, Annie. Yeah. Thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Annie Wood Cusick is the director of Auntie Martha and the Nene Goose, which opens Friday and continues for the next four Saturdays at Honolulu's Tenney Theater. And you can learn more about the show at hpr2.org.
Cold sets in. Polar Vortex sounds like a sci-fi villain. It's a real-life North American stalker.
Mixed up, I'm so mixed up.
Mixed up? Try the temperature in Augusta, freezing in Maine and Georgia. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Throughout the year, you turn to HPR2 for news, information, and ideas. We've been there for you, and now we're counting on you to be there for us. Financial support from station members makes the programming on HPR possible. We gratefully acknowledge Mac McCoy of Waikoloa, Oakley Lip of Kihei, and Johnny Lacewell of Honolulu for your membership support. And now it's your turn. Make a tax-deductible contribution to Hawaii Public Radio today by calling 955-8821 during business hours, or you can click Donate Now at hpr2.org.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting the Aben Quartet, Classical Strings and More, this Friday, mauiarts.org. Also at Doris Duke Theater on January 12th.
Last month, the controversial State Historic Preservation Division got a new administrator, and none too soon for the agency under fire locally and by the National Park Service. Just 2 weeks into his tenure, SHPD's Alan Downer is seeing the effects, and Civil Beat's Chad Blair joins us to fill in the details of today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
I guess the good news is that SHPD has a head now. That's a good thing. But there's a lot that's expected of him awfully quickly, given the fact that SHPD's been in the scopes by local folks and certainly by the Park Service.
Downer's from New Jersey originally. He's an archaeologist. He has a degree in geology, a PhD in anthropology, a lot of experience for this job. He beat out 30 other candidates to take the position, but you are absolutely right. He's under the gun already. There is an April deadline from the National Park Service that if SHPD doesn't meet the requirements, they're going to lose federal certification and funding. It's a very big deal. This has been under fire from 2010, actually, and SHPD has just moved slowly. Downer's predecessor actually resigned last summer, unable to fulfill most of those requirements.
He's also had a state legislator ask him for records in a very public and formal fashion.
That's right. He felt a little shocked. He's like, well, why don't you just pick up the phone and call me instead of filing a public records request? But there is a concern about transparency, lack of transparency, is SHPD. So clearly Downer has his hands full, not only with the laws that he has to work with, but he's also got a PR problem. I mean, this is the agency that protects Hawaii's cultural and historical resources, a very big kuleana.
So at this point, it seems almost a case of, well, which problem do you handle first?
Exactly, and he's expressed confidence that the National Park Service concerns, that's at the top of his list. And we'll have an update, I'm sure, come April when that deadline comes around.
All right, well, meanwhile, at least there is someone who is minding the store and hopefully shepherding it in a more positive way. Thanks very much, Chad. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Sounds good, Bethann.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Supply, announcing Radiance Reflective Roof Shingles, solar reflective shingles designed and made for Hawaii to reflect the heat and help keep homes cool. Learn more at radianceroof.com.
Local story with global reach. Scientists looking to better understand and predict the effects of climate change got some help recently from the Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory. Researchers at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and the University of California, Santa Cruz used the Pisces 5 submersible to study deep sea corals. And they say a long-term shift in Pacific Ocean nitrogen content is one more result of climate change. They also say this study is the first detailed biochemical record for the planet's largest contiguous ecosystem. Lawrence Livermore staff scientist Dr. Tom Gilderson joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Now, this report is in the current issue of Nature, but for people who haven't yet had a chance to look at it, make the nitrogen connection for us.
Sure. So one way to think about the way that the ocean works, particularly the biological side of the ocean, is to think of it as an equivalent to what happens on land, where you have plants that take sunlight and convert that into physical matter. In your yard, it would be grass or trees or shrubs. In the ocean, there are a host of microscopic phytoplankton, which do basically the same thing. They take incoming sunlight and dissolved inorganic carbon, and they make their tissues out of the inorganic carbon and sunlight. Just like your garden, the ocean also needs some fertilizer, and like your garden, the ocean is mainly limited in a lot of places by nitrogen. And in the ocean, nitrogen ends up being utilized by phytoplankton, just like it is used in your garden. And there are two primary sources of nitrogen to the surface ocean where phytoplankton can use it. One source is from nitrate, which is brought up by upwelling from water that's slightly deeper. So as plants die, they fall through the water column, and their tissues are decomposed or remineralized, putting the nutrients back into the water at depth. When this water mixes back up into the surface ocean, it brings the nutrients back up with it. So that's one source of nitrogen for the phytoplankton. The other is actual nitrogen in the air. The air is about 79% nitrogen, and while water sits at the surface, it exchanges gases with the atmosphere, and there are these amazing and wonderful bacteria that will fix nitrogen and make it usable by phytoplankton.
So as you were looking at the deep sea coral, the idea was to be able to track how this nitrogen was being used and what you actually saw in those skeletons of the coral.
Correct. So the skeletons actually act just like a sediment trap. So in the oceanographic community in Hawaii, there's a very long, wonderful time series at Station Aloha, which is managed by the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And what researchers looking at modern processes do is they have these big funnels out in the ocean, and the funnels collect and trap material that sinks from the surface water. And our deep sea corals are basically doing the same thing. They feed upon sinking phytoplankton, sinking particulate organic carbon, and then incorporate trace elements and isotopes from the phytoplankton into the skeleton of the coral. In this case, we were using what's colloquially known as gold corals in the Hawaiian Islands.
As you looked at those corals and were trying to assess, excuse me, what exactly had been happening with the nitrogen, you say that you've got about 1,000 years worth of a look. Is that a long enough time?
That's a very, very good question. And the work that we recently published in Nature, we have a 1,000-year continuous time series from a series of locations in around the Hawaiian archipelago, so out by French Frigate Shoals in the northern Hawaiian Islands and Cross Seamount and also near Oahu. But we also have other samples that go back further in time. They're just not continuous time series. So this 1,000-year continuous record fits within the larger context, and it does give us a really wonderful window of what's happening in the upper ocean.
So what is happening? What's the big takeaway that you want us all to remember?
Sure. The big takeaway, without getting into too many details, is that the coupled ocean atmosphere and biological system is remarkably nuanced. What we have found is that in the 1,000 years preceding or leading up to about 1850, the end of the Little Ice Age, as known in the Northern Hemisphere, and also, interestingly enough, about the start of the industrialization period, the nitrogen sourced by the phytoplankton looked to be about constant. Since 1850, we've seen a significant change, about 20% increase in the amount of nitrogen fixation by bacteria in the surface ocean and the gyre around Hawaii relative to a source of nitrate. And one way for that to happen is if the upper ocean becomes a little bit warmer, a little more stable, it's not having as much dynamic mixing with waters from below bringing up the nitrate. So what this time series from the corals do is it allows us to tie directly in to modern observations such as those made at Station Aloha. And we see this increase in nitrogen fixation as a source of nitrogen to the base of the food web, interestingly enough, as I said, at the beginning of the industrialization era and at the end of the Little Ice Age. So the coupled ocean biology and climate system is very intimately linked, and it works in sometimes very subtle ways.
So what happens now, Tom, now that you know this? Where do we go next with this?
Well, that's a really good question, and one of the things we always get asked, and not surprisingly enough because of the time scale and people's interest, how much of what we see is natural variability, the Northern Hemisphere coming out of the Little Ice Age, versus what might be produced by global warming or anthropogenic climate change. And our data unto itself cannot tease apart those two. Undoubtedly, we have some combination of the two. So what we need to do is work with ocean modelers to try and do some sensitivity experiments to see how much of a change one might expect for one forcing mechanism, such as anthropogenic warming, versus just natural climate variability.
And any idea when you'll be able to do that comparison?
That would be dependent upon various funding
sources. It always comes down to funding.
You know, it's not exactly playing craps at the table, but it's close.
All right. Well, we wish you good luck then as you sit at the table, and we will talk to you hopefully soon.
All right. Thank you very much, Beth Ann. Have a wonderful morning.
You too, and thanks for your time, Tom.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Dr. Tom Gilderson is a staff scientist at the Center for Accelerator Mass Spectrometry at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. He's also an adjunct position at the Department of Ocean Sciences at the University of California, Santa Cruz. His research focuses on revealing past climate variability He's part of the team working in cooperation with the Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory to document the long-term shift in Pacific Ocean nitrogen content, they say, is a result of climate change, and you can find the entire report in the current edition of Nature.
In our backyard quiz earlier this morning, we took a look at the United States Geological Survey's Lava Flow Hazard Zone system. Implemented in 1974, the system is a way of ranking the severity of danger posed by volcanic lava flows for specific land areas. Though the system is used in various places throughout the islands, it's most useful on Hawaii Island, where the volcanic activity is constant. To determine and define the level of danger, the USGS closely examined the lava flow history of all five Hawaii Island volcanoes. Currently, the system uses a numerical scale of 1 through 9 to delineate those levels of danger, and zones classified as 1 have the highest level of hazard. On Hawaii Island, those are found near the summits and rift zones of Kilauea and Mauna Loa. For our quiz today, we asked you to tell us the name of the two geologists who originated the lava flow hazard zone system. They are Donal Molyneux and Donald Peterson. It's 8:47, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Good morning. I'm Al Harrington from Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Our next conversation flows right out of our quiz. Now a look at the world's most studied volcano, Kilauea. After 31 years of its current eruptive phase, Kilauea continues to be an extraordinary living laboratory. And for all we've learned over the decades, there's still much we don't know. And for more on that, USGS Hawaiian Volcano Observatory geologist Tim Orr is on the line now. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. How are you, Chris?
I'm pretty good. This is the opportunity of a lifetime for somebody like you, yeah, as to study.
It is, in many ways, a dream job, yeah. It's not a job that many people have, and I feel very lucky to be in this position.
Are there many places anywhere where you could have the kind of opportunities you have here?
There are other active volcanoes around the world, volcanoes that are very active. In Italy, for example, some in Central America.
Yeah, I was thinking
Hawaii is really the only place where we have continuously produced lava flows.
Yeah, and continuously produced lava flows and the opportunity to be fairly physically close to it, right?
Exactly. It's, you know, you have this, you know, nearly continuous activity. It's been going on now for 31 years, as you said, and it's relatively safe and it's easy to access. And moreover, not only do we have lava flows now on Pu'u'o'o, but we also have an active lava lake. So we have two different styles of activity at the same time.
How are those styles defined, Tim?
Well, you have, you know, for example, at Pu'u'o'o, we have an eruption which is producing lava flows. You know, they're flows that are coming onto the ground surface. And whereas at the summit, you have a lava lake. So it is an eruption. Mm-hmm. There is lava reaching the surface. It's just circulating within a lava lake and then cycling back into the deeper system. So there are other places in the world where there are active lava lakes, but none are as accessible as the one here.
When it started up, and it was just after New Year's Day 83, right?
Yes.
Some of the fountaining was 1,500 feet straight up, yeah?
It was very spectacular. For the first 3 months, the eruption kind of shifted around between different parts of a fissure system, but then by June of 83, it began producing the high fountains. Mm-hmm. And then those fountains occurred about every 3 weeks or so, and they lasted about a day each.
Mm-hmm.
That went on for three more years. So it was, almost predictable. The geologists at that time, not me, I'm a newcomer compared to that.
Yeah.
Those geologists could, in a sense, you know, forecast when activity would start. They would see behavior changes at the summit and along the rift zone, you know, seismic changes, and they would be able to travel out, hike out, and actually be in position when the high founding started, and then could document through the entire period of high founding for each of those fountains.
You can also document as the lava. When I first saw it as a news cameraman, Tim, there was about a 7 mile, literally a river of molten rock going down into an ohia forest. And you've had the opportunity to sort of document almost day by day the cooling process, right, which is the literal formation of Earth.
That is true. I mean, the flows that come out, they are building up the land's surface. I mean, so far, there's been about a cubic mile of lava that's been erupted. And, you know, it's hard to fathom what a cubic mile is, but to put it in other terms, that would bury the entire island of Oahu beneath more than 8 feet of lava. So it is building up the ground surface, and a lot of the lava that is coming out and erupting is going into the ocean. And we can't even see what it's doing beneath the ocean's surface, but it is building up the flank of the volcano, flank of the island, underwater as well.
And that's how, at some point in geologic history, that's how everything got started.
That's right? How all these islands were formed, same process.
What are the, you know, in the areas that have now become familiar through this 31 years of study, where are the areas where you're still looking? What are the kind of mysteries that remain, Tim?
That's always a difficult question. It depends on who you ask.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
what are you curious about would be a better question.
You know, the area that I work on is a lot to do with how the summit and the rift zone are connected together. And with the opening of the summit lava lake, the summit vent, that has given us a better view of how those two systems are now connected. Because we know that magma rises up from the mantle, from deep within the earth to beneath the summit, and then from there it has to travel laterally through the east rift zone about 12 miles down to Pu'uo. And just how that process works and, you know, how the system evolves along the way is an interesting question. Is the magma coming into the system? Is it one big batch of magma that's continuously supplied, or is it, you know, different batches of magma that come in, evolve, and then are erupted? And there's a lot of questions that are, you know, everything that's happening, you have to realize, is happening, you know, at several kilometers depth, you know, more than a mile down, and
yeah.
You can't just see it. You have to make inferences based upon the chemistry of the magma that's erupted,
mm-hmm.
based upon the seismicity. There's a lot of questions about the entire plumbing system of the volcano that still need to be answered.
What is seismicity?
Well, seismicity is just basically the shaking of the earth. So mm-hmm. you know, when
vibration, kind of
vibration, right? When magma comes into the ground, it's pushing aside the rocks. It's causing a vibration in the ground, and then also you have that pressure will cause parts of the volcano, the south side of the island, to actually slip. Those are also being felt here. We have, you know, a few hundred earthquakes per day. Most of those are not felt, but they are occurring every single day.
Those are what you would categorize as seismic events, something that would register on a meter?
Right, yeah, the ones that we actually are recording with our seismometers. And those are in addition to the constant vibration that's always being recorded by the seismometers.
You're describing an Earth that's almost trembling there in that
area.
In
many ways it is, yeah, that's true. It's not something that we can feel, but the seismometers are sensitive enough that they can pick up these very weak seismic signals that are coming in.
And that wouldn't happen in a non-volcanic area, right? Or would it?
No, not what we're seeing here. I mean, this is clearly in response to the fact that this is an active volcano.
That's it really has a kind of a fascinating picture, or the fact that you can't paint a picture of it and have to kind of extrapolate from the data that comes your way. That's an ongoing challenge for you, isn't it?
It is. I mean, this isn't like a storm that's, you know, blowing in, not like a hurricane where you can have satellite imagery, you can, in a sense, see it coming. You know,
yeah.
Here we're looking at activity which is more than a mile below sea level, and And that's where the magma chamber is, and it's rising from even deeper within the Earth. I mean, these are places that we just can't reach. So we have to use other types of equipment. You know, the signals that we're receiving, both how the ground changes shape, you know, swells, shrinks based upon magma coming into the system or leaving the system, as well as by the seismicity that's created by those changes.
It's part of the mysteries that still remain. Tim and I, thank you very much for talking with us this morning.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
You bet. Tim Orr is a USGS Hawaiian Volcano Observatory geologist who will give a free After Dark in the Park talk tonight at 7 p.m. in the Kilauea Visitor Center in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. Details can be found at hpr2.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the four hospitals of Hawaii Pacific Health, Kapi'olani Medical Center, Palimomi, Straub, and Wilcox Health. We're four hospitals helping Hawaii to be powered by health. Learn more at hawaiipacifichealth.org.
New Letters on the Air celebrates winning the 2013 Clarion Award for Best Interview Program by featuring excerpts from the five shows submitted, including Jamaica Kincaid's.
It's not about my own ambition to be a writer in the world. It's about my ambition to write.
Insights from Jamaica Kincaid, Luis Alberto Urrea, Jim Shepherd, and others on New Letters on the Air.
This evening at 6:30, right after Marketplace.
This half hour, we had a whole lot of science.
Yes, we did. And I was fascinated by the things that, Tim Orr from the Volcano Observatory was saying, because you know, there are always areas that are still, that remain mysterious under the sea, deep in the earth. And
a lot of scientists are very grateful for that, because it's keeping them employed.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, we'll never get it all figured out, but it's got to be exciting to be on the trail of new information like that.
And always feeling that there is something on the horizon. And if only you can unlock part of it, you may get yet another part, which will probably lead you to another quest. But that's a lot of wonder to keep in the world, which I think we need a lot of that these days.
Better believe it.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for us for this Tuesday morning. Now, up tomorrow, what took many by surprise in and out of the East-West Center? We'll talk with the head of the Energy Group about the unit's resignation.
And Frank DeLima will be with us to talk about his ongoing work in Hawaii's school.
You can suggest a conversation you'd like to hear. Just post it on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at Because HPR.
Past shows, links to more information, lots of other good things are archived on our website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandenberg.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning right here for more of The Conversation.